This is the Washington University School of Medicine Oral History Program. Oral History number 50. May 6th, 1981. My name is Paul Anderson, and this is our series on alumni of Washington University School of Medicine. And I'm speaking today with Harriet Smith Kaplan, MD, class of 1956. Let me begin with a review of Dr. Kaplan's career. You were born in 1929, began college at the University of Wisconsin, transferred to the University of Southern California, and received your BA in zoology at the University of California at Los Angeles in 1951. In 1952, you entered Washington University School of Medicine and graduated, as noted, in 1956. You were an intern at San Francisco General Hospital, part of the Stanford University Service, in 1956 and 1957. And a resident in internal medicine at Wadsworth Veterans Administration Hospital in Los Angeles, 1957-1959. Then you were assistant research physician in the Department of Nuclear Medicine and Biophysics at UCLA, 1962-1964, followed by a period of 6 years, 1964-1970, in private practice, part-time in internal medicine. In 1970, you re-embarked upon residency in psychiatry at the Los Angeles County Harbor UCLA Medical Center, a facility at Torrance, California. You were certified in 1973 in psychiatry. No, so you're correcting me to say it's 1979, but your training in psychiatry ended in 1973. And you've been associated with Torrance ever since in various capacities.
At the UC, Harbor UCLA Medical Center, I've remained there on staff.
I see.
Since completing my residency in psychiatry.
Okay. Well, since 1973, you have also been assistant professor of psychiatry.
Right.
Clinical professor at the School of Medicine.
Right.
UCLA.
First in charge of psychiatric emergency service, and more recently the psychosomatic liaison service.
Are there any other corrections that we can make in your?
No, I think that's the main thing.
In your vita? Okay. Well, to begin now, were there any factors in your family background or childhood which influenced you to study medicine?
None, except for the emphasis on the need for men and women to have an education. That was the primary, I think, orientation of my family. I had no immediate relatives who were physicians, but some distant relatives. But on the contrary, most of the people in my life earlier on felt that being a woman, it would have been far more useful for me to be a nurse than a physician, since that was the common calling for women if they're in a medical field. And so my initial interest at about age 16 or even younger to go into medicine was kind of frowned upon because, one, the long training period that would necessitate, and two, being a woman, the thing I was often confronted with was that, what's the point of going into medicine when you will probably get married and stop your training, and it's so hard to get into medical school anyway, so why not go into nursing? After starting my pre-med work at University of Wisconsin and the tremendous influx of veterans from World War II at that time going into med school or trying to, I was temporarily sidetracked into nursing. So I actually finished 3 years of a five-year program, which I really don't regret because it certainly at that point gave me the strength of my convictions to pursue medicine instead of nursing, regardless of one's sex or the potential difficulties with practicing it or not. So at that point, with the strength of my convictions, I went back to pre-med and graduated from UCLA and then to med school.
Mentioning Wisconsin, did you grow up in Wisconsin?
Yes. I was born in Milwaukee, had temporarily gone to Philadelphia for a few months, I'm told, and moving back to Wisconsin, to northern Wisconsin, all my formative years were in a town called Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Oh, that now has a branch of the University of Wisconsin.
Right, when I left there, it was still teacher's college, uh-huh. With a promise of becoming an extension of University of Wisconsin, and I'm having not returned there. I look forward to seeing that.
Where did you do your nursing training?
Well, at University of Wisconsin then, pre-med became pre-nursing for me. And my family, having moved to Southern California, I followed them after 2 years of undergraduate work and went to nursing school at what is referred to as Big County, LA County SC Medical Center, and took a year of nurses training, at which time I was also taking classes at USC, working towards a degree in nursing. And after exactly 1 year of that, I could comfortably and with a great deal of confidence say I wanted to be a physician, as my original inclination was, and not a nurse.
So this accounts for your transfer to what was doubtless a pre-med curriculum in zoology, with
right.
a concentration in zoology.
Right, so I went back and resumed pre-med courses in a track towards med school.
I understand you were a lab assistant in biophysics and physiology at UCLA.
Right, from 51 to 52, after I got my bachelor's degree in zoology. I worked at the then very new medical school, UCLA,
uh-huh.
and which was a very interesting experience for me, and again, gave me even more confidence that I had found the right niche, that I wanted to go to med school.
Were you still shopping for medical school?
I guess you might say that, you know, in view of the times, as well as wanting some experience and a little work. And it was really at UCLA, which was then, I worked really in that capacity with the very first class of medical students taken into UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And then that year I was applying to medical school. And had a lot of encouragement from people when I was fortunate to be accepted by Washington University, that no matter where else I might be accepted, I ought to go to Washington U, mm-hmm. because of its fine reputation.
Mm-hmm. What specific reasons were advanced why you should apply and choose here?
Originally, probably one of my reasons for applying here was rather frivolous. I applied to some schools on the East Coast and some on the West Coast. I needed someplace in between. And Washington U was one because a gentleman I was working with in the Department of Physiology at UCLA knew of Washington U from a family contact and spoke very highly of it and encouraged me to apply here. And I did.
Mm-hmm. Who is he?
I was afraid you would ask. I believe it was Dr. Robert Smith, but I'm not sure. However, fascinating, his relative at Washington U was Dr. Kennedy, is that the one who co-discoverer of plutonium?
Oh.
Is that correct? Yeah. And I think that had been a relative of his. And it was very exciting to hear about all this. And like I say, I felt fortunate when I was accepted here. And even some people at UCLA who had just come to create this medical school there, encouraged me to accept this acceptance, mm-hmm. even if I had others to consider.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite an adventure for me, because I really had never been to this part of the country. Being a Midwesterner, yes, but not this far
mm-hmm.
south.
I gather you had a summer project at UCLA in 1953 mm-hmm. In pediatrics. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about this?
Well, again, that was an interest that was stimulated here in retrolental fibroplasia, which was fascinating because it was a new disease of premature babies or very small infants. And nobody understood at that time the etiology of it. It was an increasing scale. It was manifesting itself large numbers, and it was very frightening because these babies were becoming blind, many of them, or impaired vision from this condition. And I did a little literature research project on it here. And then from that interest, I worked at UCLA with a pediatrician who was very interested in it for that one summer. And it was fascinating because they were considering, tremendous extremes of causes for it. Mm-hmm. But it really turned out to be something that was really right there under everybody's nose. Unless they come up with some other cause now, it was the increased oxygen tension that these babies were being exposed to. And what was the clue to that was most of these babies were coming from fairly well-endowed hospitals, not from general hospitals, but from hospitals that were getting these fancy new Armstrong incubators that allowed for a very high oxygen tension. Mm-hmm. That the baby was exposed to. And apparently this was later then felt to be the cause of this devastating problem.
Were you there when this discovery was made?
I can't say I was there, but I was certainly one of the people who was right, on the margin of it, at least very excited about it when it did show itself. Is to mm-hmm. cause, because there were very extreme things they were considering, all the way from vitamin E deficiency to mother's milk, cow's milk, and I've been away from it now for many, many years, but I understand there's some resurgence of interest in it, and wondering if they really did have the total answer, so I don't know at this point.
Well, back to St. Louis now, what do you recall about the preclinical facilities of Washington University when you were a student?
What do I recall?
Yes. Were they adequate to your needs in retrospect? How did you find them then?
The preclinical years?
Yes.
Well, I had no exaggerated needs as far as the preclinical years. I prefer to think that I was one of the students that felt that I had the respect for this school and that they would know what I needed. Now, as far as conditions, sometimes labs were a little crowded, but one of the things I remember about it is most of our instructors in the preclinical years were very cordial and encouraging and supportive people. And it was very exciting to work with people who were famous. And who some of them were even good teachers, mm-hmm. not necessarily all.
Can you think of any people who impressed you?
The Coreys, I remember.
In particular?
I had Gertrude and Carl Corey. Gertrude Corey was already ill, so I really saw very little of her, and unfortunately, I think her demise wasn't many years after I started here. Mm-hmm. But Carl Corey was a very exciting man to listen to, especially knowing about his fame and his accomplishments. There were lots of others in neurology, even though Dr. Erlanger, I think, was emeritus already at that time. Mm-hmm. It was still exciting to be sort of almost in the same room with people like that. And from time to time, mm-hmm. he would give us a little talk or come around. Mm-hmm. And then there was, of course, Dr. Lowry of pharmacology, who was a fine, and always had been a fine gentleman and a good teacher. And always had time for students, mm-hmm. So I remember them well. As far as, because I'm sure you would want to ask me about Dr. Trotter.
Yes.
Dr. Trotter was a very pleasant lady. I enjoyed having her as instructor. But if you think because both being women that she would have been more embracing of some of us, I didn't truly feel that she was. I thought she was pleasant. I might have taken advantage of the fact that she was one of my few female instructors more than I did. And I think she had extended hospitality, invited some of the women over on rare occasions, and I don't believe that I ever had either the chance to accept an invitation. So maybe I was, unfortunately, didn't get to know her as well as I might have, and part of that was my doing. Mm-hmm. But her enthusiasm was always contagious, and always very, you know, when you think about the years she'd been doing it, and to remain that enthusiastic about what she was doing was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, she still is. If you and like I look to for, know, I speak to her very frequently. And
I would like to hope that I'll have a chance to see her during this reunion.
Well, as long as you brought it up, it's something of very great interest to us. How were women medical students treated?
How were women medical students treated? Probably as well as their attitude on an individual basis warranted. By that I mean, I personally don't think I felt very much prejudice because I was a woman. I was aware of the fact that there were prejudice, and the very fact that our class had two women in it in a class of 86, as most medical schools did in those days. And when I would go for an interview in some place and be confronted with, why should we accept you? You're going to get married and have children. Sounded much like family and friends from the past. I would just say, well, look, you know, you're going to accept a woman or two, and I would hope you'd want a normal woman. And I feel that I qualify, and so it'd be useful that that woman might be me.
Did you hear comments such as this even after you had become a medical student?
Not so much. I think some of my male classmates had their prejudice and their biases, but that would not have been surprising. There were enough, the class was large enough, that I could have and did have and do have, I hope, some enough in the class to have good friends, regardless of the sex. Strangely enough, I had very little contact with or very little relationship with the other woman in my class,
mm-hmm.
which maybe isn't surprising. Just two women, why should we necessarily be together just because we're women? As a matter of fact, that wasn't the case. There wasn't that much friendship between the two of us. As another woman came into the last 2 years, I had more of a relationship with her than I had with the previous one.
But your training didn't differ in any degree?
No, I can give you an interesting example. This would have been in the clinical years, though.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name, my professor of urology. I think it was Dr. Cordonnier.
Yes.
Who was a fine fellow. And it was really fun because he took great pride in telling us, this was either our junior or senior year, I forget, that the women in the class were the best urology students of that year that he had, or he spoke for. And then he went on to inform us that did we realize that at Stanford Medical School in those days, female medical students were not allowed to be participating in anything to do with male urology. And here, there was no such bias, nor should there have been, because it really is the attitude of the individual or the respect of the individual towards the patient and vice versa that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, and this may be my compensation, I don't know, I felt it was an advantage most of the time, not always, along the way, to be a woman in medicine. You know, whether it would be the mother figure or sensitivity or caring, most of the time I felt that I did not experience much prejudice from either patients, regardless of sex or color or anything else, or my faculty. I think some of the students, fellow students, may have been a little prejudiced, but towards women, chauvinistic, okay? But allowing for that and appreciating that there would always be that, some of that, I think I was not particularly you know, overwhelmed with any difficulty. Some of the other women, and I maybe someone has spoken to you about this before, I think some other women medical students, many of them were very nice and very supportive and kind, but on the other hand, there were several women students at this school who were far more sexist, if you will, and when you could have used a little support and a little friendliness from them, just bent over backwards to be anything but friendly.
So they were brusque and non-supportive toward
other women. I speak for myself, towards me. For various reasons, either afraid that their love affairs were going to be discovered, or maybe chauvinistic in their own way towards other women, wanting to perhaps not share what was going on.
That's interesting. You mentioned clinical training. Could you describe any incidents or any reminiscences that you come to mind?
Well, even before that, there was one reminiscence I'm sure you'd enjoy at the preclinical years.
Okay.
I think it was as in pathology, because it was wild. To just show you that we had a rather playful, friendly group, as I'm sure most medical students will tell you they are part of the time. I remember on one occasion being stuffed into a locker by some of my classmates and having the locker closed, only to be pounding on it to have it opened. And I forget who it was, but one of the professors came along, opened it, in very good humor, just, you know, said greetings, how do you do, and walked off and let the door open so I could get out. You know, and I think it was really wild.
Do you recall who that was, your rescuer?
No, I don't. I don't. I think I was so probably embarrassed.
Uh-huh.
Hello. And it was so awkward that I'm not sure who it was. In fact, I can't tell you right now
who stuffed
me into the locker.
Huh?
Except that there were groups that I'd study with or what. But it was really funny.
Student hijinks of...
Yes, there you go. A good name for it. Yeah.
Well, what about these the clinical years?
All right. I loved them. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly enjoyed the clinical years because you were starting to get closer to being a physician. And I liked that. Plus, had some very fine people to instruct even beyond your professors or whatever. One of my very favorite interns at Barnes Hospital that I could remember, who always had time for the medical students to give instruction or how to do a procedure, turned out to be and is a professor of medicine at UCLA now and has been for a number of years. And we don't cross paths, that we don't reminisce about the days when he was an intern and I was a medical student. And he is a relative of one of our distinguished faculty members, Dr. Lou Guzet, Sam Guzet's brother.
Oh, really?
Is a very fine gentleman and one of the warmest, probably one of the most liked teachers yet at UCLA. And I'm sure that's just taking off from the days when he was a good teacher, even as an intern.
Oh, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, he's a very fine fellow.
Well, what do you remember about the physical facilities of the medical center in those days?
Well, I was being a northern girl. I guess I was a little surprised, a little bit chagrined and upset to find some of the prejudice that was still existing in those days. Like, I remember hearing how proud Barnes Hospital was in the medical school that they were now integrating at a racial level. And I thought, well, you know, great. But come into the wards and find that integrated to an extent, which meant that the black patients were in ancillary rooms off on the side, not mixed with the Caucasians. Or I think I was probably here a year before I realized that the little cafeteria in the basement of, I think it must have been Barnes or one of those buildings, that was called a chocolate shop, not for what it sold, but for whom they expected to eat there.
Uh-huh. Oh. A chocolate shop. Yeah.
Is it still there?
I don't know. No, I've never heard of it. I'm glad you mentioned it.
And the medical students, we ate there, but that sort of, or sitting, the bus segregation of sitting blacks needing to sit in the back.
Was Missouri or city law at that time?
At that time, and I think it was in the state of transition then, you know, which was reassuring. Mm-hmm. But to a northern girl, this was very difficult. And I always saw St. Louis as sort of not north and not south, sort of a city with its trials and tribulations of not knowing what direction to go. But it was interesting, and I'd like to hope that it moved in the right direction and that there is more intermingling, hospital patients, etc.
You mentioned Dr. Cordonnier, Dr. Guzet. Is there anyone else with whom you came into professional contact at the medical center?
Well, there's a lot of them that I thoroughly enjoyed. I remember Dr. John Smith, cardiologist. I don't know what happened to him. I would like to see him. He was a fine teacher of cardiology. I remember him well for being able to make sounds, heart sounds and murmurs. He could impersonate them so beautifully that it just would always stay with you.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were lots of other people that made their mark. Of course, we had the gentleman in microbiology, this is not clinical undergraduate, who's now at Stanford, or I think he's still there, Arthur Kornberg,
mm-hmm.
who was a challenge. He was a challenge. He never did get around to teaching us bacteriology, but there was an awful lot of biochemistry that we didn't appreciate, you know, later for him to get his Nobel Prize from.
I was just going to say,
When
was it that he won his Nobel Prize?
It was a few years down the line, so that would have been around maybe the late 50s. I'm not sure, but it was on DNA, and as I remembered, it seems to me as though he had us as medical students synthesizing DNA in the microbiology class, and we wondered, what does this have to do with microbiology?
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, his class, there were a lot of things in it that we wondered what it had to do with microbiology. He was a challenge, and not always with the well-being of the student in mind,
mm-hmm.
and the needs of the student.
He put research as he saw it first. And
research first, but I think it was at a personality level. He would be a little bit caustic or challenging and always with an ear-to-ear smile at the same time. You couldn't read him right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But obviously a very capable, bright fellow.
Where did you live when you were a medical student?
Oh, I thought you'd never ask. Well, those were the days, Dr. Anderson, when the men had a dorm to live in. That's one prejudice, it's true, sexism. There was a dorm for the men, but I couldn't feel too badly because that building was already condemned. They were living in a dorm that had already been condemned. As for where I lived, I came to St. Louis a whole week early to find a nice room so I could, settle down. Because they had no facilities for women. None. And I looked around. I found a place. I forget, one of those big boulevard streets not far from here. Forest Park,
perhaps?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I found a room there that I looked awfully nice and clean, and I was all set to go, and now it's about the weekend before school starts, only to find out that the lady of the house, that owned the house, if she wasn't psychotic, she was sure pre-psychotic, and very strange, and her whole purpose was for me to introduce her rather strange, retarded daughter to medical students. And so here it is the weekend, and I knew that I better get out of there. So I ended up living in a place that I was always grateful that my mother and father never came to visit me that year, because they wouldn't believe the kind of dump it was. It had just been vacated by a room in a boarding house, rooming house by a man who ran or owned one of the little greasy spoon restaurants a block away, who used it for sort of just a flop house for himself. And he had given that up, that room. And I was desperate at that point. Its location was fine. It was right near Euclid and Forest Park. See, you're bringing back all of these memories. So I cleaned it up as best possible, literally scrubbing the place, and lived there. But like down the hall were some truck drivers living. Across the hall was a female medical student who was one of those I described to you earlier, who would make sure her door was never opened. In a year living there, she never said hello to me, and would very clearly had to deliberately stay in a room or not open it if I was around. Just very afraid to be discovered, I think. Uh-huh. You know, it was too bad, too bad. But right next door, this was like a twin building, there were a couple other female medical students living who were far more cordial. So that was my first year, quite an experience. But a lot of medical students were very friendly and very supportive. Not the least of them, and the name will sure mean something to you, Dr. Dan Nathans.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Who at the time was Dan Nathans. He was 1 year ahead of me, or 2 years ahead of me, who was very pleasant gentleman, a very nice human being, who kind of took me under his wing when I needed to get a microscope, and which was interesting, and he ends up getting the Nobel Prize using one.
Uh-huh, yes.
He took me under his wing, helping me choose a microscope that would be good quality but used. And we spend several hours together socially, just orienting me and being just a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him warmly for that. But then after that, my housing improved, and my experience with it improved. The second year, I lived with Mrs. Marriott, who was at the time the widow of Dr. Marriott, who had been head of pediatrics, hadn't he?
Yes, yes, and I was also dean of the medical school.
Okay, I had even forgotten that, and she's a lovely lady. I moved into her house, though, and I tell my husband this, because my husband, Mel, who is an internist, had experience of having, he was chief of medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in the later 50s, and you had this young lady working under you as a resident, didn't you?
Intern
and resident. And what was her name again?
Nancy Landon
had left Mrs. Marriott's house, but Mrs. Marriott was understandably a little upset because she left a family of baby skunks in her basement.
Oh my.
Mrs. Marriott, who is a very proper, very lovely lady, just didn't know how to handle a family of baby skunks in her basement.
I wouldn't know either.
And I was involved in getting rid of them. Uh-huh. They're awfully cute, but we did have to turn them over to some society or other.
Well, did the organ for which skunks are best known come into play at this time?
Apparently not. Huh? No, it was just anticipating that it might.
Uh-huh.
Was a problem. Uh-huh. But she was most upset to think that she would go off and leave this poor little family of skunks there.
Well, yeah. I had the impression that Dr. Marriott had moved to California just prior to his death. And how was it then that you recall that Mrs. Marriott came
back? Well, maybe
back
she moved back. Maybe she moved back because I lived with her in 53 to 54.
I see.
And then after that, for my last 2 years, I lived with a friend of hers who is a delightful lady. And I don't think it's senility, but I have had a terrible problem trying to remember her name. She was, at that time, 86 years old.
Huh?
Very independent, marvelous lady on one of these gas-lit private streets between, well, just about maybe half a mile from here off of Euclid.
Mm-hmm.
She had this big, marvelous old house, which her family really did not want her to remain in. But she kind of pacified them by having people stay with her occasionally.
I see.
And she had been 86 in those days, late 50s, and had been a biology teacher when she was younger. So this was a very intelligent, very charming lady.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed in this big, lovely house with her 2 years, and there was another female medical student living there the last year. Mm-hmm. So that was, those last 3 years made up for the first year, which left something to be desired, but was tolerable.
The students of the 50s are sometimes referred to as a docile, silent generation. Was this true for you or and your fellow classmates?
Well, that must have been students of the 60s who said that.
Uh-huh.
Because I think they would just like to think that they were more verbal. Docile? No. I couldn't have been docile and gotten into med school.
Mm-hmm.
See, I spoke earlier that I didn't really experience much prejudice. But part of that is because I chose not to interpret it that way. But I had to be a woman's liver, if you will, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
before, you know, all the noise was made years later. And you couldn't be docile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can, you know, you can tell now I'm not exactly have trouble expressing what I'm feeling.
So assertiveness comes natural. You don't have to do assertiveness training.
As opposed to being aggressive.
I see, yes.
There's a difference.
Assertive, yeah,
that's right.
That's
right.
Positive.
That's right. I'm very, you know, I can be assertive when necessary, but I prefer to think not nearly as often am I aggressive.
Well, what about rules, formal or informal, that govern students at the time?
Conscience.
It was all internalized?
No.
Why were they different from they are for what they are now?
Of course, now I think we're not talking just about rules and regulations for students, but for all people, all mm-hmm. young people. The generation has been liberated overtly, as opposed to having to quietly assert itself more often than not. So I don't think it has anything to do with medical students per se, except I work with medical students, by the way. You know, I teach medical students. And I am amazed often by some of their attitudinal problems. Or some of the dress codes are gone.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are times you're fortunate if you can tell which one is the patient and which one is the physician or the student. Because in a county hospital, they're often the patient comes better groomed than the house staff officer who is attending to him.
Mm.
I think it's a sad commentary from that point of view. Because I think that is a disrespect of the patient.
Well, with looking back to the...
Back to then?
Back to the 50s, were attitude problems less because there were these...
I think attitude problems were a little less back then because even though now it's not that easy to get into medical school, but then I think there was maybe, and I use this word advisedly, a more matured individual trying to get into med school. There were big numbers of veterans coming back. There were people who, like now though true, you know, who may have had more graduate work waiting around to get into med school or other experiences. Something that they wanted. Medical school was something they wanted for themselves. There's always still, and was then and now, the one who goes to medical school because mama or papa want them to, or because it's a tradition. But I really think there was a little more maturity in some of the students then compared to what there's now. I worked with medical students, as I said, and obviously there are lots of outstanding ones, but I marvel sometimes at some of the problems that some of the medical students have in attitude, in respect, self-respect as well as for others. Now, this has to reflect not just the student, but the people who are accepting them into the medical school, see. I think that that's often neglected. Is almost from year to year, as admission committees change, there will be a totally different mass personality for those students who get in.
Really? And you think attitude is something that can be read through applications?
Well, not necessarily. Now, there's always personal interviews and letters of recommendations. And we both know, and we all know, that letters can be misguiding and masking of things. But it is interesting that in any one year you may see a group that seemed to have more problems than in another year, or a different orientation, a far more individual, much more scientifically oriented, if you will, as opposed to more better read or into more sociology and history, whatever. I suppose if you, the docile 50s, I'm not quite sure what would have made us docile except just pounding our heads trying to get into what we want to do. And now, a lot of the people of today, I hear much more complaining. This is interesting, and Mel, I don't even know if we've talked about this. I hear more medical students now at a stage of internship or post-in their internship or early residency, bad-mouthing their experiences and their fact that medicine and the lack of imagination and this and that, which I think is...
What specific ways do these expressions come forth?
Well, something as subtle as, I hate medicine, and wishing they hadn't gone into medicine, or really intending to leave it, supposedly, although I haven't seen much of that. But a great deal more of taking off, finishing your medical school, more often your internship, or your residency, and then going around the world for a year, or doing just odd jobs or working in emergency rooms, having not been able to make a decision about what you want to do with the rest of your professional life, medical. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people taking off, traveling, or doing something else for a while, as though they hadn't cleared their own mind what they really want to do when they grow up. Mm-hmm.
Although, as I'm sure you know, that's always happened, I'm reminded by this talking about taking off, but one of our pioneer plastic surgeons, Vilray Blair, apparently took off a year in the middle of his medical studies to string telephone wire in the Rockies.
And that may be fine. I think they did it.
1890s. So.
Okay, I think they do that. In fact, we have a friend, obstetrician, gynecologist, who took off and did farming for a year. I think they always have done some of this. But I think some of the reasons were different, or at least expressed differently, and there are larger numbers are doing it now. Now there's more affluency, maybe. Maybe it's easier to go around the world now or to take off than it used to be. Everybody was pretty goal-oriented back in the old days, quote-unquote old days.
I had this distinct impression that in this age of the Bakke decision, without getting into the specifics of that case, that there was such demand to get into medical schools that no one would ever consider, unless they wanted to drop it altogether. The opportunity indeed would not present itself to get back in once you had dropped out.
Yeah.
Well,
I think they're dropping out at stages more commonly after internship.
I see.
At a breaking point.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Or before internship, between med school and internship. Uh-huh. Although that's harder. But after a residency. Or I know several now, having been disappointed and not getting the residency they wanted, are planning just to take off and think about it. And many of them, the other big difference, Dr. Anderson, is that there are many more married medical students and house staff people now than there ever were, 25 years ago.
And yet it was allowed in the 50s, was it?
Yes. I understand there were certain fields that did not allow it, supposedly, or totally discouraged it.
Well, do you recall
surgery,
which these were?
Surgery. Some places I understood, and I don't have, I can't say it authoritatively, but maybe Mel would know. But years and years ago, there would be some surgery residencies who would say that, you were disadvantaged if you were married, and they expected them not to be, and many times wouldn't accept someone who was. But now medical students are often married, interns and residents are often married. And I think that, although it meets many needs, it makes for a lot of satisfactions in one area, is another source of dissatisfaction and problems. Because now with the pressures of internship, medical school, residency, besides dealing with those, they have to deal with the discontentment of a spouse who isn't getting enough of their attention or enough of their time, or isn't in a position where you would expect her or him to appreciate the demands of the work. So unless somebody has her or his own identity, own drives and needs met, and comfort with herself or himself, I think you are asking for more discontentment and dissatisfaction. Many of them ending up with divorce or some other kind of acting out.
Earlier we mentioned blacks as patients. Do you recall blacks or other minority, members of minorities who were medical students when you were a medical student?
In my class we had none. However, I remember distinctly talking with various people here how they were most eager to have minorities on their in the medical school.
This was already in the 50s.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But what they were finding was that there were not a lot of blacks applying then, and of those who did, they were not qualified. They had, I think, in a year or two behind me, ahead of me, I beg your pardon, taken a couple of black students, as I understood it, really bent over backwards to make every effort to support them and to encourage them. One, I think, dropped out, and the other transferred to another medical school within a couple of years, something to that effect, and they were really unhappy about it. Now, in those days, you know, women were minorities. You know, you mentioned the word minority. And right or wrong, for what it's worth, you know, Jews were considered minority. At a time when it wasn't an advantage to be a minority. Of course, now Jews aren't considered a minority anymore when there could be some advantage. But, you know, again, the women were certainly a minority group. But we've spoken about those issues.
Tell me something about your internship.
My internship was a rotating internship at San Francisco General.
Was this the normal to have a thing, to have a rotating internship?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I can't tell you exactly the year it stopped, but at least back then, in order to be licensed in California, you had to have a rotating internship. And to this date, I would urge and support that thought or that requirement, because I think a rotating internship is a fine experience for someone who's just finished med school.
Well, one of your classmates, I believe Dr. Geisy, was telling me that they were already discouraging rotating internships here at Washington University.
Yes.
Was that an issue that you were aware of?
Yes. Well, at Washington U, you know, jokingly would say that they didn't feel there was much medicine west of the Mississippi River anyway. You know, just like in the West was no man's land.
So that was a common...
Yes, and it may still exist for all feeling. I know. That feeling may still exist. I don't know.
Certainly they've learned some things about the West since then.
Right, right. If they only came West, they'd find out, right?
Yes.
But rotating internship, I thought, was great. However, I must say, I could have chosen a place that would have been a little easier to cope with than San Francisco General. However, by the time I finished a year rotating internship there, I often say I could have practiced rural medicine anywhere in the world and been pretty well equipped.
Say rural medicine?
Rural.
Yeah. Why rural?
Well, because I learned how to treat and diagnose patients with less than necessary sometimes, but less than ideal conditions, and with less than ideal support of laboratories and other modalities.
Would you say that San Francisco General was comparable to St. Louis City Hospital?
Probably. probably. But it has advantage in that, which was exciting, like its emergency room service. San Francisco Hospital, General Hospital in those days, and I don't know now, but I think it's still true, was the only big emergency room for all of San Francisco. So it was a tremendous experience. And I liked my internship. It was hectic, very hectic. But for 1 year, like I tell people even now, the internship is a self-limited disease. It's over in exactly 1 year, and the sequelae from it aren't necessarily too devastating. Mm-hmm. You live through it most of the time.
Well, being part of the Stanford service, I imagine you met many Stanford graduates. How did you compare in your training to them?
I did then, and I still think that our training here was as good, if not superior, especially as far as attitude, because since you mentioned it, I must tell you that as an intern, looking forward to working with medical students, I was very disappointed in the attitude of many of the Stanford medical students who felt to work with a live patient was interfering with their book reading.
Really?
Yes, and I remember having a couple of encounters. One example was being on call one night. I had this patient come in who was a very classic pulmonary edema problem. I called up, as I should, the medical student who was scheduled to be on call to see the patient. This was about 11 at night. His response was, "Well, what does the patient have?" And I said, "Well, wouldn't you like to come and examine the patient? We'll talk about it, so you can decide." "No, well, what's going on with the patient?" I said, "Well, it's pulmonary edema." And he said, "Oh, I've seen one." And I'll see him in the morning. I said, "Well," at that point, I said, "Well, I'd like to hope that he'll be a great deal different by morning, and that this is your opportunity to participate in this." That was not a rare attitude. Now, I'm told that that particular class, and that's again class, was a little less than ambitious and interested in what's going on.
You're not aware of any reform at Stanford, which...
No, no. No, Stanford, though, is, you know, fine medical school mm-hmm. in many ways. They are rather non-structured mm-hmm. in the courses that they expect of their students. But I think that's probably a little trend of many other schools now, too.
Because we had an interview recently with a former dean at Creighton University who described reforming the school and with a specific aim at changing that attitude that students were no longer to have their noses in the books all the time and would indeed get that clinical exposure.
That's right. I think that's really vital to correlate anything you learn from a book is to see it in the flesh.
Well, tell me briefly then about your residency at the Wadsworth VA Hospital.
Oh, well, I can tell you briefly about that. Compared to a general hospital experience, which I always liked, and I obviously still do, or I wouldn't be at a general hospital, on staff. The VA was a slow, tedious pace. You know, where patients can stay almost as long as they choose to, that there's no push to get them out. It was an interesting experience in that I had some good teachers. Their staff in those days was very good. But it was a big change for me from a general hospital to a veteran hospital. And I felt that that was, you know, the 2 years there was quite enough.
Was it unusual for a woman to be a resident at a VA hospital? Other than outside of being in a minority?
Well, that's an interesting question. I frankly, let me think about it. I think there weren't very many of us. There weren't many women anywhere. So I wasn't, you know, overly aware of that. The difference is that they had no female patients.
Mm-hmm.
That was a conspicuous difference. And they had a relationship with what is now called Harbor UCLA Medical Center. In those days, we just called Harbor General Hospital, LA County. And they would send a resident, each medical resident, to Harbor General Hospital for 2 months of female medicine. And everybody looked forward to it because
of their very outstanding chief of medicine there, who was a fine teacher, and that's Mel Kaplan, who I very cleverly later married.
I see.
Afterwards, he was very ethical. We never even dated while I was there.
I see.
But long before there was any social encounter, I really felt that the experience at Harbor General was really what they had said it would be, a fine experience with a lot of support and good teaching from my husband, who wasn't at that time my husband.
Well, when did you marry Dr. Mel Kaplan?
Well, I was on the service at Harbor General Hospital September and October of 57. We started to date middle November, and this was dating this gentleman who was called a confirmed bachelor by some of his associates. We dated starting mid-November. We were married February 23rd of 58.
I see.
So that was a rather fast-moving courtship.
Well, judging from your vita, you were still associated with the VA hospital.
I was, yeah. So while at Wadsworth, I went from being Dr. Harriet Smith to Dr. Harriet Kaplan on the same ward, which was confusing to some of the patients.
Uh-huh. There is a 3-year lacuna in your vita following this period.
And lacuna is probably a good word because I had babies.
I see. So the eldest of your three sons was born at this time?
Well, actually he was born in 58 while I was still a resident.
Uh-huh.
And if you might believe that some of my colleagues to this date will often remind me of how I was walking around with ACE bandages on my leg and acutely pregnant at the VA hospital. All the other times we've had encounters, you know, but they take great delight in teasing about that time.
Well, how did this affect, other than the ACE bandages, your practice?
Well, as a resident, it wasn't, didn't affect it too much. Sometimes at the end of rounds, we'd have to sit down and we'll talk about the cases so I could elevate my legs.
Uh-huh.
We'd sit down and talk about them, but otherwise, it didn't interfere too much.
The attitude of your patients was affected in any way?
Well, you know, with white lab coats,
you
can cover up even a pregnancy sometimes.
I see.
But they were all very cordial about it.
Uh-huh. So you didn't actively or regularly practice medicine at all for a period of 3 years? Is
it? Well, very little, really. I would go into my husband's office a little bit, but not really. I, you know, go to a meeting. I do a little reading, certainly, but no, I really did not. So, and then we had our second son within a year, 19 months of the other one, so it kept me pretty busy. And then between the second and third son, I was in nuclear medicine for the 2.5 years.
Just going to come to that. Right. How did that opportunity open up?
Well, at that, you know, I was eager to get back into professional life more, and that was such a new and exciting field. And I had an opportunity, again at Harbor, to associate with the nuclear medicine department. I knew the woman who was running the department, and then had the good fortune of knowing a gentleman who was probably one of the nicest people I ever knew, who was head of nuclear medicine at UCLA, Dr. George Taplin, who was one of the big pioneers of nuclear medicine. And spoke with him, had the opportunity, got into the field where I was for the 2.5 years. Did some of the first lung scans at Harbor General Hospital ever done. So it was fun to be in an area that was so new.
Did you ever run into Dr. Crawford Sams in connection with nuclear medicine?
Name sounds
familiar. He was a brigadier general in the Korean War,
yeah.
And he also, I believe, at San Francisco, was in nuclear medicine. I could be mistaken.
No, I didn't. Now, you know, this was a department that was mainly run by internists, as opposed to radiologists.
I see.
And which I think still should happen, you know, because of the pathophysiology.
Well, what did your work entail?
Well,
most of my work was really dealing with the clinical aspect of it, dealing with the patients, evaluating, participating to some extent in getting patients for the studies or getting studies for the patients. When I had to make up my mind a little later on about what I wanted to do with the rest of my professional life, as an internist, I certainly could have continued nuclear medicine and it would have been very compatible with family. But in all honesty, I was not as interested in the physics and the machinery of the field and did not envision myself staying in it forever. And through various processes, in spite of Mel, who I think many years ago said, "Go into anything, honey, but psychiatry," I'm sure with tongue in cheek, was quite supportive of my going into psychiatry.
This didn't happen for quite a time span yet, though. For 7 years, you practiced.
During that time, I was doing a little part-time practice with my husband, doing a little lab work, not as much as I would have liked. But then, by the time all of our children were in school, is when I made the decision to go back into another training program.
Why did you do that? What led you to decide to become a psychiatrist?
Well, one, the appreciation that almost any field you're in with a lot of patient contact, you're going to be doing psychiatry, whether you choose to or not. So I thought to have a background in psychiatry was useful. I've often found myself in a situation of being an ear for people or needing to listen to problems. I like that kind of relationship. I enjoy hearing people's problems, if you will. And number three or four, whichever one it is, it was possible to get a training program 20 minutes from home. Very practical when you have three little kids.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, part of the appeal was, and I think it was very cagey of them, they led me to believe for a while that I could get one of these modified programs, that I could go during school time when my kids are in school and be off with them during vacation time, which was already going on in some parts of the United States. And that was very appealing, you know, having an extended residency then over 4 or 5 years. And so I did get things set up so I could do that. And at the last moment, they told me, "Gee, I'm awfully sorry, Harriet. You know, we're glad to have you full-time resident, but we can't make these other arrangements." So by that time, my taste buds were up for it, and I was ready to take on a residency. And so I plunged in. It wasn't easy, but I did it. Especially household help was a problem and remains a problem. If somebody wanted a cause in this country for women in who want to work or be in professions, that would be an admirable cause of proper care for children in homes. But I had Mel's support, my husband and my children supported it and were very cooperative, and I did it.
Well, tell me about psychiatry briefly. We're running out of time, I realize, and I hope we can continue for a few more minutes. At Harbor.
Well, I was comfortable at Harbor because I'd been there in various capacities before. It was, during the time I was there, my department was fairly analytically oriented because of the chairman of the department, Pietro Tedesco, who is now at Vanderbilt. He is an analyst. And that's particularly interesting since it's a general hospital that you would have a psych department that was psychoanalytically oriented.
Does this mean Freudian?
Freudian, right.
Orientation?
Right. But it did allow those of us who were interested in a more eclectic approach to get, you know, some background in that. And I prefer to see myself as an eclectic. As far as the training there goes, let me say that 25 years ago, or at that time, let's say right after my medical school and so forth, I probably would have wanted to look for a fancier, more elegant training program. But
I mentioned maturity before. I guess in the number of years and having children and being at the place I was matured enough at that point to appreciate that it's not how fancy a program is, but what your attitude is and what you get out of it and how much you put into it. And since the choices weren't that great, I wasn't going to go to some other state or some other city, and I didn't want to drive huge miles. I went to this program, and I really felt that I got a fairly adequate psychiatric training. And then I was asked to stay on in psychiatric emergencies, and I liked it. I like what I'm in liaison consultation.
I take it you have always felt that psychiatric care and psychiatric wards have a real place in the general hospital, particularly the large general hospital.
Oh, yes. That's one of my favorite subjects. I think my feeling is, remember I have internal medicine background, nuclear medicine background, okay. I think that it is essential that there be at least some psychiatric beds in a general hospital. I am concerned about strictly freestanding psychiatric units because many, many organic diseases manifest themselves with psychiatric problems, but they need a good general medical approach. You know, I think psychiatrists need to be physicians who are specialized in psychiatry. They mustn't, divest themselves of their role as physicians interested in the patient's medical well-being as well. Plus, being in psychiatric emergency work, I personally saw, let alone am aware of, many catastrophes that present initially with psychiatric manifestations brought to psychiatry and have had catastrophes happen, not the least of them death, of course, but seizures and many other problems. So without being in a general hospital where these could be attended to, I think it's really irresponsible to have them anywhere else. Now down the line, that might be different once they're triaged and observed, and then some select ongoing patients that psychiatrists have, fine. But I would be much more comfortable with most psychiatric problems first seen and dealt with in a general hospital.
How has your assistant professorship been a part of your career in this regard?
It's been compromised in a sense that it's only one of the many hats I need to wear. And that's just a fact that I need to accept. And maybe it's what I want. I don't know for sure.
What do you mean by compromised?
Well, I can't devote as much, or I don't, or won't devote as much time to my professorship, as you call it, or to my role as a faculty psychiatrist, as I might want to, or maybe sometimes should, because I'm also a mother, a wife, a homemaker, and I, right or wrong, I have continued to maintain a lot of involvement in all of the above. So, the publish or perish thing is a risk. I have a little advantage in that I'm not right in a big mecca. And where other things are considered. But this is an area where chauvinism is still manifested. Women yet, and by my choosing, are into all these roles with emphasis distributed across the board. Whereas most men, maybe not the newest generation in medicine, maybe not. But most men give priority to their profession and the other jobs become come next in line.
How much, what percentage of your professional time is devoted to academics?
teaching, supervision, the whole works, a lot of it, about comfortably, I would think, at least a half or more.
What does it mean to be in psychiatric emergency service?
I was head physician of the psychiatric emergency service crisis. It means heading up that section, having interns, residents to supervise under you, social workers, in the administrator of that area, which is another role. Relating to the community, you know, dealing with the problems that come up over it, evaluating, teaching.
Do you go outside the hospital much in your work?
Not a lot, but in psychiatric emergency work, I did more than many other psychiatrists would in other areas, because you are always worried about and need to deal with acute psychiatric beds, being able to find some when your hospital has limited numbers, working with community mental health agencies who send you patients to be evaluated, so forth.
Do you have any particular, any research projects in the fire?
Let me think right now. I've just finished going into publication, a chapter for a book on seizure disorder, the psychiatric aspects of seizure disorder. I'm very interested in group phenomenon and doing an interesting group with visiting nurses. I would like to do a little writing about that.
Will these be psychiatric nurses specifically?
These are hospice nurses.
Oh.
And we're doing group therapy with them over their feelings about having to do hospice work and what it does to them. A very stressful situation that they're in. And that would be interesting to write about, because I'm sure that hasn't been written about. I don't believe it has yet. And I just had something come out in emergency medicine. I relate a lot to paramedic training. Mm-hmm. I teach paramedics psychiatric emergency work. And I had an article come out in Emergency Medicine Journal just last month, mm-hmm. about mental status, about evaluating patients and so forth. I like teaching about mental status examinations of patients, because I think it's so important to separate organic from functional.
Well, that brings us up pretty much to the present. Is there any major stage of your activity that we've glossed over?
I think we have shortchanged a little bit, if you will. My family, mm-hmm. and I'm very proud of our three sons, mm-hmm. and my husband, who we can be very proud of.
Well, you mentioned his position when you met.
Yes.
What position does he hold now?
A very high position.
I see.
He's a private practice of internal medicine, but having been chief of medicine at Harbor General Hospital, having been resident there, for the last 3.5 years, he's been president of the Professional Staff Association of Harbor UCLA Medical Center. So he's one of those few people who has had experience at that institution almost from every aspect possible, so can bring to it tremendous expertise. And as I said, you know, I appreciated him as a teacher even before I realized that I could appreciate him as a husband. Mm-hmm. Our three sons, our oldest son is a medical student.
Where?
At Harvard. And I should say that he had a nice problem of having a number of places to choose from, and really had a struggle with the choice. I think it boiled down for him between Washington U and Harvard.
Oh, so he could have gone.
Yes.
Come here.
Yes, he had been very privileged to come here. In fact, they had offered him a scholarship here, and he really, you know, seriously considered it. He went undergraduate to Harvard, mm-hmm. and I think that that probably influenced him too. You know, he knew Boston, he liked it.
What's his name?
Robert A. Kaplan.
Mm-hmm.
And
your second son?
And Marty Kaplan is our 20-year-old, who's a junior at UC Berkeley,
who next year will be going for a year to France to study through the university. And our youngest son is a junior in high school.
What's his name?
His name is Roger. And he's very busy and, you know, is in the throes of thinking about college now. So we're very proud of our sons. And just hope they'll all find happiness and contentment regardless of what they do.
Well, it seems like you've had a very well-rounded and fulfilling life in many major respects. Is there anything else?
No, except that I thank you for the invitation of participating in this program. And I think you can tell that I do enjoy talking about it. And it was kind of fun because it gave me a chance to reminisce about things I hadn't thought about in some cases for 25 years.
Yes, well, I hope you have the opportunity to see some of your old haunts in St. Louis. You might find Euclid Street if you haven't been back in the city recently.
25 years.
Changed quite a bit. It's kind of the, after fashion, the art quarter of the city now. There's a lot of restaurants and a lot of renewal and a lot of antique shops. And so it's one of the more interesting areas. St. Louis perhaps doesn't shine as one of the world metropoles, but when people want to go out in the evening, they frequently go to Euclid Street.
Well, so thank you for the recommendation. Yeah. We'll look forward to seeing it. This is my husband's first time in St. Louis ever. So 25 years later, I'm going to introduce him to it.
Well, welcome to you both.
Thank you.